地獄に飽きた。体の中を風が音を立てて抜けてきやがる。雨は嫌だ、風も。そよ風、せせらぎ、梅の匂い。そんな夢みてえな里があったっけ。2年、いや3年なるかな。
1969, Zatoichi took the year off. And who can blame him? Since the launch of his series in 1962, The Blind Swordsman, destined to wander the back roads of 19th century Japan, equally renowned for his deeds with flashing sword and the rattling of his dice cup, had racked up 19 films, almost 3 films per year. So in 1969, I guess he was entitled as anybody else to a bit of a breather. But as the franchise reached its 20th release, they knew they had to do something special. Maybe that's what they were spending the year 1969, gathering steam and getting ready to relaunch this and take the franchise to a new level. And so in early 1970, Zatoichi met Yojimbo. And that's what I'm here to talk about on episode 12 of Criterion Reflections. I'm David Blakesley, the host of this podcast, where I gather each time out with a guest or two to talk about a film from the Criterion Collection and all of its affiliated formats, Filmstruck, the Eclipse series, even back to the old Laserdisc days. And today we're going to talk about Spine Number 679, or at least one of the many films, the 25 films packed into that lavish, glorious box set. Zatoichi meets Yojimbo, starring, of course, Shintaro Katsu and the great Toshiro Mifune. It seems like a dream match, a pairing made in samurai heaven. Well, I've got a couple of flashing swordsmen themselves ready to join me in this conversation. Robert Taylor and John Lobinger. For experienced listeners to this podcast, you'll know both of their distinctive voices and personalities. And I definitely think they brought it pretty well today. So I invite you to sit back and listen to the clash of swords and opinions as we see what happens when Zatoichi meets Yojimbo. All right, well, here we are. I've got a couple guests, and we are going to be talking about Zatoichi meets Yojimbo. So let's go ahead and get our panel into the mix here. First, we're going to start with Robert Taylor, hailing out there from Los Angeles. Robert, hello again. Welcome back to Criterion Reflections.
Hi, David. I'm so sorry that we're meeting under these circumstances.
Well, you know, this town is going to have to be big enough for the three of us here as we grip our swords and show down in the main town square. My third henchman here is John Lobinger. John, coming to us from Boston, although by the time this airs, you might be whereabouts unknown. John, how's it going today?
It's going great. Thank you for having me back on.
Yes, yes. We're getting this episode in a little bit ahead of schedule. I'm going to be delaying things from the recording date today, but I'm going to be pushing this back probably into sometime in March before we release it. But John has got a pretty epic journey ahead of us. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your upcoming itinerary, or by the time this is aired, you'll be in full swing there, but tell us a little bit of what you got planned.
Yeah, I've decided that my life in the Yakuza is no longer cutting it for me, and so I am feeling the moral weight of my past crimes and am going to become an itinerant masseuse. So,
Oh, you're going on the lamb, basically. Right?
I am taking a month and a half long trip. I am going to be traveling around the Pacific, and so I'm gonna start in LA, then go to Hawaii, New Zealand, and Japan, and then come back through to San Francisco to see my brother and his pregnant wife. So I have a big trip ahead of me. I'm very excited.
Yeah, well, I'm excited for you, and I'll definitely be peeking over your shoulder, as I'm sure you'll keep us posted on some of the awesome sights and experiences that you got ahead. Robert, let me go back to you just to kind of fill our listeners in of what you've got going on. I know you've been working in the screenwriting business. I want to kind of tap into some of your experience as we get into the film discussion, but what else you got going on these days?
Season 4 of Spirit Riding Free will be released in March, so probably right around the time this episode airs. I wrote the season premiere, so I am very proud of it, and hopefully everyone checks it out with their children, and if not, just check it out anyway. It's fun. I threw in tons of references to Ozu, and no, I didn't, but it still should be quite delightful.
All right. Well, okay. I'm looking forward to checking that out. I've definitely looked for a few of your episodes, and you got a nice knack with that. So I'm definitely happy to support you, and definitely glad to have you on with this discussion of the 20th installment in the long-running series of Zatoichi, The Blind Swordsman. So we're going to take a little bit of a look at this film here, Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo, which I guess is somewhat of an epic-scaled installment in the series. But before we get into analyzing the film itself, I think it's probably appropriate to say, where are each of us at in our kind of assimilation into the Zatoichi universe? This is a long-running series. Of course, at the time, it was the most, you know, epic single release that Criterion had ever published. I guess it's been a little bit outdone by the 100 years of Olympics films in terms of sheer bulk. But there's also been some other pretty big box sets, the Jacques Demy, the Jacques Tati, even the World Cinema Project sets, if you kind of combine them, are on a pretty big scale itself. But the Zatoichi series is a major undertaking. It kind of blew a lot of our minds when Criterion first announced this big 25-film omnibus deluxe edition here. It can be approached in a lot of different ways. Robert, why don't you just tell us a little bit about kind of how you've dug into the Zatoichi and kind of your quick take on the series as a whole.
I have never seen another Zatoichi movie aside from this one. I am coming to it simply because I love Kurosawa, and I was so excited to see that there's a Yojimbo crossover. So I decided I was just going to dive in with this one. As preparation, I listened to the Criterion Considered episodes on Zatoichi. Does that count?
Sure. You're probably taking an approach that is not entirely unique. I mean, when you see Toshiro Mifune showing up, even if it's at the kind of the latter, third, fourth of the series there, he has a unique and undeniable star power. So it's like, hey, this is one of the best of the best. Let's go ahead and check it out. So I think that's a very valid approach, and probably one that others have opted for as well, as they figure out how to approach this beast.
And luckily, the name of the series is Zatoichi, The Blind Swordsman. So I feel like I didn't come in with that much of a misunderstanding as to what it was about.
Okay. Well, there's a lot to catch up on, though. So we'll probably help you sort a few things out as we get into our conversation. John, what's been your experience with the Blind Swordsman?
So Robert and I are in a similar situation. So this was my first Zatoichi. I've had the box set for a while, as I think some people, when they get the box set, they get it, they're very excited, but then they don't watch it right away. And so I have had this beautiful box set on my entertainment center, sort of challenging me to watch it, and I did not take up this challenge until recently. I did go and watch Zatoichi number one after I saw this, and then I also listened to the excellent conversation with Mark and Dave and Aaron West over on Criterion Close Up and watched the supplements and all that. But I am a big fan now of Zatoichi, and I am really looking forward to seeing more episodes. Shintaro Katsu is absolutely my kind of movie star. So this was a really fun entrance for me. and I'm looking forward to discussing, perhaps disagreeing with other people's opinions on how good the movie is. But
yep.
Okay.
I can't help it. I have such idiosyncratic taste. Like, there's a very good chance if anybody brings me on their podcast, I'm going to have a contrarian opinion. I swear I don't do it on purpose.
It just sort of happens, yeah. Well, this is very interesting. I do feel like I am the sensei with his young disciples sitting around ready to imbibe the wisdom which will flow out of me like a fountain here. So I have watched the entire Zatoichi series up to this point, and I started blogging about it back in installment number 8, which was Fight Zatoichi Fight, I think was the name of it. And the reason I started blogging about it in episode 8 is because that's where I was at in my Criterion Reflections timeline. I think that was like 65 or 66, something like that. But I did watch the 7 earlier installments prior to doing that, just to sort of say I kind of followed the journey. And so you've watched number 1, John. I mean, there's been a lot that happened between that one and this one here, but to say the least. I mean, you know, namely 18 different films. But what was your impression of the first one? Because I really feel like that's one of the great classics of the series, or you could almost put 1 and 2 together into sort of a longer form movie. They both have that same kind of classic samurai flick feel to them, but the series went through quite a bit of shifts of tone between that one and this one. So, yeah, what'd you think of the beginning of the series?
I really enjoyed it. So I'm, like I said, perhaps my tastes are idiosyncratic, but Harakiri for me is the best Chambara movie, and I can't imagine, as I get deeper into Japanese period films, that I'm going to have anything that will replace it. Like, I think it's one of the best movies ever made, and it's up there with, like, Paths of Glory in terms of international anti-war films. I just love it. But, like, that very next tier of for me, my next tier is different from most people's, because I really enjoy, like, the Lady Snowblood, you know, Lone Wolf and Cub, and episode, you know, movie, The Tale of Zatoichi. Like, they're all, for me, in that same realm of this stuff just absolutely lights my fire. And then the you know, beautifully shot. I also think that the movie we're talking, as I've affectionately called it, Z meets Y, Zatoichi meets Yojimbo, also beautifully shot.
Oh yeah, definitely, very well made.
But the main thing you take away from these movies is Shintaro Katsu. He is, yeah, I mean, I'm gonna get effusive about him. I put him up there with some of the very best actors that have just completely become one specific character. I think the person, maybe it was Jeffrey O'Brien, sort of referencing the silent era of Lloyd and Chaplin and these people that just embody, you know, the tramp, that Zatoichi is that is sort of that level for him. And so far, I feel the same way. So I'm a big fan of Shintaro Katsu right now, and I'm looking forward to watching more of these movies.
Yeah, you are absolutely in for a treat, because if you dig that basic character that you saw in both the first and the 20th, there's so much great stuff in between. Films that I think are a little bit more coherent and cohesive than this one, although this one has a lot going for it.
Coherence is not one of those things. Coherence is not...
No. This is a film that if you really want to understand it, it's going to demand some of your time, a little bit of a commitment, an investment, you might say, in understanding all the nuances. But it's also building on some pretty classic samurai chanbara genre traditions, and so that's part of the appeal. If you like that kind of thing, this movie has a lot going for it. Robert, let's kind of get some of your take. You said you loved Kurosawa, so that kind of, you know, magnetically drew you to, you know, the Mifune character reprising in a way his role from Yojimbo and its sequel Sanjuro, the only film that Kurosawa ever consigned or committed to making a sequel for was that one. Yojimbo was a huge commercial success in Japan. You can really say it kind of revived or kickstarted the chanbara genre en masse. Of course, there had been many great samurai films made before that, some by Kurosawa, some by other directors, but Yojimbo just really launched it, and so kind of as a quick knockoff, Kurosawa did agree to do Sanjuro, a short film which took some of the graphic violence to a new level. But just tell us a little bit about your experience with Kurosawa and samurai films in general, Robert.
Well, I've watched every Kurosawa movie chronologically, and by the way, he did make one other sequel. He made Sanjiro Sugata Part 2, but I don't blame you for not remembering because it's not memorable.
You're right. Well, you know, I guess maybe I think about that as Kurosawa sequels once he was in his prime. But you're right. He did that. So
yeah.
I stand corrected. Thank you.
So about a year and a half ago, I decided I was going to watch all of Kurosawa's films chronologically. I kept a nice little blog about it. I adore Yojimbo. I love Sanjuro just as much in different ways. I love that Sanjuro is basically the closest he came to ever making a screwball comedy. And so, in general, I love samurai movies, so I was super excited to see what was going to happen with Yojimbo meets, pardon me, Zatoichi meets Yojimbo. There we go. You can tell.
Well, it works the other way
I
around, too,
a little
actually.
Bit biased toward him. That said, I'm not quite sure why they twisted Yojimbo's character. Well, A, I don't know why they gave him a name. It's obviously not the same character, right, guys? It's just they were using his name, and then they just created essentially a character for Mifune that sort of maybe is a little bit like Yojimbo, but not really.
Well, Yojimbo is the Japanese word for bodyguard,
right.
And if you listen to the soundtrack, you hear them say the word Yojimbo, but it's not his name, it's just his title or his role. And so there, that's a legitimate, you know, excuse, if you want to call it that. In Sanjuro is when he sort of gives himself that name. It's what, a hibiscus flower or something like that. It's kind of a ridiculous name in Japanese. And then in this film, his name is actually given as Sasa.
Yeah, he has S-A-S-A. A real name. I was like, what the
right.
fuck?
he's but in addition to that, you can't give him a name. It ruins it.
It really does. But once I sort of made peace with the fact that he's not playing the same character that he was playing in the first two films, he's just playing a variation on the character, I sort of was okay with it, despite the fact that the movie makes a bunch of nods to the Kurosawa movies, like when Zatoichi goes into the older man's place and says, there's going to be four coffins, we're going to need four coffins, and stuff like that. I just have to wonder why the screenwriters didn't just twist it that extra 10% and essentially make the bodyguard character into the bodyguard character. I don't think it was a copyright issue because they were both released by Toho. But for whatever reason, that was all well and good. I do have a question for you, David, since you have seen all of them and John, you've seen two of them. Is Zatoichi as much of an afterthought in most of his movies as he is here?
No. This is probably the one film where he is truly kind of counterbalanced by another kind of star of sufficient magnitude to sort of constitute like a rival in terms of screen presence and charisma and box office draw. I mean, Zatoichi has a big boss showdown in every film, you know, and there's and some of them are pretty well known samurai, swordsmen, martial artists, and you know, heavies of their own heft and reputation in the ever-evolving chanbara genre that was happening in Japan in the 1960s. But this really was kind of taking it to a new level. And it's, yeah, I guess to, yeah, so the Shintaro Katsu performance is always like the central bit in just about every other Zatoichi film. I mean, every other one, even you could say including this one, where I think he still packs the punch a little bit more than what Mifune is able to deliver. And that's partly by design, and I think partly because Mifune was just a bit past his prime. I think that's my take on it anyways. But yeah, let's go ahead.
I was just going to echo what you said. Aside from Katsu, who I think was quite good in this, all of the other actors seemed a little bit bored with what was going on, as if, especially Mifune, he, after giving such legendary performances elsewhere, just seemed sort of like, okay, I'm going to cash the check now, I'm going to seem angry, I'm going to do all of the cliche things I did before, although he never scratches himself, which is, of course, what he did in basically every Kurosawa movie he did. But
right, didn't cock his head back and forth, didn't do some of those little gestures.
Yeah,
right.
He seemed like he was just cashing the check, which is, again, I think one of the reasons why I just couldn't, well, the story. But aside from that, I really felt like it was a huge missed opportunity because, pardon me, Katsu is really giving it his all, and then Mifune's just like, yeah, I'm here too,
I think that's kind of where Mifune was just at in his career, honestly. He had been living the movie star life. There had been some pretty legendary frictions with Kurosawa himself. In fact, apparently his willingness to take on a Yojimbo role created sort of the last straw between him and AK, and they kind of had a permanent rest of their lives falling out. You know, also the harrowing experience of Red Beard and the career opportunities that Mifune had to pass up so that he could stay committed to having the beard and doing the thing that he had to do for that particular film. Those are all sort of in the background here, but really, Mifune to me sort of seems like the guy who's been living kind of a posh life and has kind of gotten a little bit cozy and comfortable in his affluence and his movie star prestige, and you're right, he just kind of phones it in, kind of shows up. I mean, he does some cool stuff, and he delivers his lines, and he does his Mifune-ish thing, and it is entertaining, and it is pretty cool, you know, to sort of see that spectacle, that pairing of the giants. But because Mifune himself was a little bit, you know, on the jaded side of things, I think it doesn't maybe live up to that legendary expectation that you might have been hoping for just coming in from a fan's perspective.
It also doesn't help that their big battle lasts all of 30 seconds at the end.
Well, and that's sometimes what you get in certain samurai films where the big showdown really is a very quick bam, bam, and it's out. So that's not entirely unexpected there. It's the power with which those few seconds or couple of minutes or whatever is delivered, which kind of sets it off rather than a long extended set piece. So I'm okay if they don't really need to elaborate or go on at great length. John, you got any comments on that little exchange right there just to kind of get you in the
mix? I've made John so furious. He's unable to articulate.
Yeah, just don't let me give you a massage right now.
Oh, those poor men.
No, the two things I have to that I think about on this topic are, one, I know that Okamoto, director of Sword of Doom, so amazing director for this film. In fact, probably the most prestigious director of all of the films. I know that there had been some discussions that there was conflict between the two stars, between Katsu and Mifune, about who would win the duel at the end. I think that's in the booklet that comes with it. So perhaps there was some of that superstar ego battle that was going on behind the scenes, and perhaps that also contributed to Mifune not necessarily delivering the most powerful performance of his career. I think for me, part of the reason why this movie works for me better than it works for other people, besides the fact that it's just my introduction, and so just meeting Katsu and meeting Zatoichi was just so exciting for me that I really got into it, is that I'm not as big of a Mifune fan as I think most people are. Now, it's a lot less controversial than I'm making it sound. He's obviously one of the greatest actors to ever live and has been in many of the greatest films ever made. But he just...
That's right. Put your sword back in its sheath there, Robert, okay? Let the man speak his
mind. But best. I don't come to a Mifune film saying to myself, like the way that I do with Setsuko Hara, for instance. Like if I'm watching a movie and I know Setsuko Hara's in it and I haven't seen it before, like I'm excited to watch it for her. I do not have the same thing with Mifune. And so coming into this movie, I wasn't disappointed that it, you know, if his that his performance wasn't necessarily as stellar as some of his other movies. So that didn't bother me as much, and that wasn't as much of a hurdle for me.
Well, okay, let's talk about this particular film then as it functions in the series. There had been a little over a year that had lapsed between the release of Samaritan Zatoichi at the end of 1968 and Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo at the beginning of 1970, January of 1970. So a year and a few weeks, that's not really that big a deal, right? Especially in nowadays terms. But in Zatoichi installment years, this was quite a significant gap. During the mid to late 60s, they were pretty much coming out at the clip of three Zatoichi features per year. So Zatoichi fans are pretty well used to getting a new installment every, you know, 4 or 5 months or so, kind of like how the Beatles and the Rolling Stones used to release multiple albums in a year, because good grief, if we go 6 months without an album, the kids are going to forget all about us and they won't buy our records anymore, right? So I think he sort of had a similar thing happening with Zatoichi at that time. So the fact that they took a full year between you know, installments, and they did, they brought in Kihachi Okamoto, very influential director there. He did Sword of Doom, he did Kill, he did Samurai Assassin, and was very highly regarded. Maybe not as well known now, although Sword of Doom I think is pretty broadly embraced by a lot of Criterion fans and samurai genre fans in general. That was also a kind of a Mifune showpiece where he was paired up with Tatsuya Nakadai, another great pairing of legends that didn't exactly result in the big showdown that you were hoping for between the two leads, although Sword of Doom is a pretty incredible film and was actually meant to kick off, if not a franchise, at least inspired a sequel, but because of the bleak nihilism of that film, it just didn't quite catch on commercially. It holds up much better nowadays, I think, in contemporary tastes. But so they had, you know, high prestige stars. They had a first-rate director. Even the female actor Ayako Wakao, she had a pretty illustrious history. She was in Floating Weeds, and she was in just a number of really top-notch films. And the late Alan Fish, I know he's a pretty respected writer. He passed away a couple years ago. He's a real high and kind of writer and aficionado of Japanese cinema. He wrote a very nice article about Ayako Wakao that puts her at the very forefront of Japanese female actors, and I'll put a link to that. It's definitely worth checking out as he kind of celebrates what she brought to her screen acting career. You know, she's the female lead in this one. She's perhaps a little bit underutilized, but she's still another significant presence in this particular cast that's been put together. So it seems to me, and maybe because this was number 20 in the series, they decided, hey, this is number 20. Let's make an extra big deal out of it. So this film had high production values. It's long. It's just a few minutes short of 2 hours long, which
sure
is.
Well, and you know, the typical Zatoichi, again, they can put these out two or three times a year because most of them were about 85 minutes long. So very efficient, very economical. You know, you have almost the basic kind of TV setup. You know, Zatoichi wanders from town to town. He stumbles across some poor person who's in a bit of distress. The village is being run by these, you know, Yakuza thugs, and they're exploiting the poor, and Zatoichi finds a way to kind of weave himself into the mix here. He stands up for the poor and defenseless. He uses his gambling skills, his almost supernatural abilities to manipulate objects that not only a blind person, but no ordinary mortal should have the ability to do the things that he does, but he's got that knack. And then, of course, a few badass sword fights, you know, peppered throughout the mix, culminating in one big showdown. There's your, you know, stock and trade Zatoichi flick, a great Saturday afternoon or evening out or whatever the case may be. You go in there, you catch the latest punch from Zatoichi, and you get on to the ordinary things of life. It seems to me that Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo was meant to be sort of an escalation or an elevation of the typical installment there. And I think in many ways it meets the challenge, but it is one that's probably best suited for people who have, you know, understood the journey that Zatoichi's been on and maybe have a little bit more familiarity, at least from what I'm kind of reading in the in Robert's nonverbals and voice tones over here. This one might leave novices in the dust here.
So it's supposed to be the Captain America Civil War of the Zatoichi series.
I think actually that's not a totally inaccurate comparison, because this one really does epitomize and captures and tries to enlarge on some of those themes beyond just the standard, there's bad men running this town and we got to do something about it, which is the general, plot momentum of a typical Zatoichi film. And now there are also different variations. Sometimes they tend to be a little bit more comedic, a little bit more lighthearted. Sometimes they tend to be a little bit more emphasizing big visual set pieces, you know, battles on bridges or, you know, nighttime fights with lanterns and flames and fire in the background setting the atmosphere. Sometimes they tend to be a little bit more spiritual or philosophical. You know, Zatoichi's wrestling with the fact that he's a man who seeks peace, but he's made his living by violence and carnage and the reluctant warrior who's drawn into having to take the lives of at some level innocent men, you know, ordinary men who are caught up in the machinations of the gang boss who's sending them to their doom as they circle around Zatoichi, you know, 5, 10, 20 swordsmen deep, and Zatoichi just slices them all up to ribbons because he just has to, and he feels sorry that he has to do that, but what choice does the guy have, right? So that's kind of the dynamics. You know, you don't really have to watch them in sequence because it's not like one picks up at the conclusion of the other. They're each very episodic, but this one here really is kind of, in a certain sense, trying to be the granddaddy of them all up to this point.
Well, you've sold me on watching at least another episode of the series. Which one would you recommend we start with? Which one would you recommend start with? Should I just do the first one of the series?
I guess that's my default option. It's always going to be go chronologically, you know, just to kind of, try to follow along. But I think Zatoichi's Cane Sword is a pretty good one. I'd have to flip through it and maybe see Zatoichi and the Doomed Man. I think I had some pretty good reactions to that. The one after that, Zatoichi and the Chess Expert.
Wait, there's a movie called Zatoichi and the Chess Expert?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they're all really fascinating. I do think that if you go back and just... Yeah, and again, some of them are pretty short and pretty quick to get into. You might find yourself just, you know, kind of caught up in it and intrigued, and just like I said earlier, it's a good Saturday afternoon type of a movie. Just doesn't really require heavy analysis or deep reflection. Although if you want to give it that, there's enough there to give a little bit of a payoff too.
So, and it is Saturday, so.
So I know that Zatoichi and the Chess Expert, actually, I think in Japanese, it's more appropriately titled Zatoichi Goes to Hell. So, okay. and then Hell and Fire, I think, play a theme just from the reading and the supplement watching that I've done around these movie series. Hell and Fire play a theme, and I think another popular favorite Zatoichi movie is actually the one after this, number 21, the Zatoichi at the Fire Festival. I think there is a consensus, at least perhaps in our circle, that this might be the worst of all the Zatoichis, which for me is exciting because I like this well enough that I'm excited to see the rest of them if they're all going to be even better than this.
Well, John, I will say this. There are some very good parts of it. I very much enjoyed lots of individual moments. I personally, I might be dumb, but I did not guess that the gold was going to be kept in the statues.
Did you really not?
I really didn't. I totally didn't. I was like, really? And then I also have to admit that I enjoyed the Treasure of the Sierra Madre style ending with the gold, you know, blowing away on the wind. I thought that was very, very good. And there's one shot in the movie that I think is going to linger with me longer than anything else, which is the sex worker walking through the rain in that beautiful little cap and walking into a room, and just the look on her face is stunning. It's during the rainstorm sequence. So beautifully lit and so well directed. So, yeah, there's good things in the movie. It's just that the good things are surrounded by the other things.
And the last thing, the Treasure of Sierra Madre, I mean, you definitely get the sense that Zatoichi films are in this like feedback loop of Westerns being informed by samurai movies, and now the samurai movies being informed by Westerns, and then the rest of Hollywood, and of course Treasure of Sierra Madre, the gold at the end, causing everybody's death, that goes all the way back to Canterbury Tales and The Pardoner's Tale. This, like, the stuff that went on in this movie, it is a totally convoluted plot, but I think I'm at a point in my life where I've just decided I don't care if plots are so convoluted I don't like them. If I'm still transported by the movie, or there's exciting visuals or whatever's going on, I'm actually finding that a very pardonable sin. And part of it is I just watched Dune. I just rewatched Dune, and I watch it, and I'm like, this plot is insane, and this dialogue is the worst. And I'm thinking, I love this film now. What is going on with my movie taste that I'm just completely forgiving these? And there's no mistaking it. This is one of the most convoluted plots. I notice we haven't really tried to explain the plot yet, and I think it's because we're all scared.
I'll give it a shot.
Well,
all right. Well, okay. Well, I will say I like the audacity of it. But you're right. This is a film that gives a certain type of fan service. I think, kind of like in Japanese cuisine, there's a certain appreciation for what we might consider in the West, very marginal slices of the fish, or certain tastes that we quite haven't acclimated ourselves to in films like this. And there are others in the Zatoichi series where you kind of have to go through them twice, or you need to even go onto Wikipedia and just kind of read the plot summary to sort of make some sense of it. You're not going to connect with all the pieces right at the first time. But I think there is, within that broader Chanbara genre, an appreciation for how convoluted and complicated and tenuous the connections are between one character and the other. And if you blink for a minute, or you don't quite recognize what's being dropped in this little piece of dialogue, you're not going to recognize the reveal 30 minutes later when it whizzes right past you and somebody shows up and it's like, that's the good son of the gang boss, who's still virtuous but he's on the bad side of his wicked stepbrother. it gets really, really messy. I think there's some people who really enjoy watching the construction of that, and until you've kind of crossed that bridge, it's just going to be confusing and somewhat bewildering, and then in that sense kind of off-putting. And so even people who I've read reviews of this particular film who have a pretty negative take, because they just think it's one, a wasted opportunity because you've got the great Mifune, but it doesn't sort of seem to hit those classic resonant notes of the great Kurosawa performances, and it's longer than usual, and because it's just, you don't necessarily feel real smart at the end of the first watch, at least, because what did I just watch here? And I sort of get the sense that, yeah, everybody died because they couldn't get the gold, but what was going on in between the parts there? So I will go ahead and try to give a quick summary here. This is my improvisational shot at it here.
David,
okay, so Zatoichi,
Godspeed. Okay, we are rooting
okay,
for you.
Yeah.
You can do.
Are you prepping yourself? Are you taking a breath?
Yes, I am. Yes, and let's put the baby bumpers down the gutters, because I might roll this one off the lane if I'm not careful here.
Definitely,
okay.
So definitely let me jump in at some point to talk about the inflationary monetary policy element of this movie, because that's my favorite part.
What happened? Yeah, I fell asleep. Sorry.
Some insider knowledge here. Okay. All right. So Zatoichi, in continuing his wanderings, has decided after his year off between installments that it's time to go back to his hometown, where he hasn't been for the last 2 or 3 years. He wanders in and he's tapping along with his cane. There's been some kind of a brutal murder in this kind of storm-drenched kind of open space. It's not really ever clear to me what the importance or consequence of that is, although it's kind of a thrilling, pulse-pounding way to open the film, which I guess is probably the function that it was placed there for. But he spends the night in a little shelter out of the storm. He wanders into town, and as he's tapping with his cane, he comes across what looks to be like a graveyard. There's all these statues kind of, that seem to him kind of new to the area. He comes into town. He sees one of his old friends, Tomo, who's a blacksmith. He's making a sword. Oh, also in the process of defending his life, his cane sword breaks. So he asks this local blacksmith to make him a new one. Even though this is supposedly a peaceful little village where nothing ever happens, it makes sense. It's good to be prepared. So he needs a replacement sword. So he presumably orders one, and he gets it later on in the film, although you never see it formally delivered. But he finds out in the meantime that this town has been kind of overrun by this Yakuza gang that has been kind of running the show. And, you know, of course, as is typical in these films, oppressing the local population. You know, Zatoichi wants to go to the local, hot springs and kind of spend some time in the pool listening to the sound of the nightingale, but he really can't do that because the criminals and the gangsters are just running amok in the place, screaming, hauling women over their shoulder, carousing, you know, doing cannonballs into the hot springs, and basically, you know, messing Zatoichi's ability to achieve a tranquil vibe that he's been looking for all these years and throughout all these films. And so Zatoichi recognizes that these guys have the gangster tattoos, those full black elaborate peacocks and landscapes, and decides to dislocate some shoulders to kind of show that he doesn't really approve of this sort of thing. And that's kind of what sort of sets all the conflicts in motion. Now all of a sudden the local crime boss recognizes there's another kind of bad dude in town, and that's where we first meet the Yojimbo, the bodyguard. He's a hired hand, that's the Mifune character, who's been kind of employed to seek out the secret of this missing gold that's been rumored. The son of the clan boss, the old man, is on the outs with his dad, but he's still kind of got his own little power base, his own little clique, and he's trying to figure out where the old man has stashed the gold. Am I tracking so far? Are you guys getting that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So that's what it was about?
Well, that's basically, that's the start of it, okay? So you got the but then there's another guy who comes in. There's a good son who doesn't really come on screen until well into the film, almost towards the end. He's the one who's still on the good side of the dad, and the dad kind of wants to bequeath the fortune to him. But there's all these intrigues that are set up to figure out where is the gold hidden and who's going to find it first. And so there are other assassins, other gangs, other rivalries happening underneath all of that. And then there's the Umano, I think is her name, the woman who's kind of the, I don't know, I guess she's a good woman who's been forced into prostitution by the gang, and she can't even talk to Zatoichi. He remembers her. He tries to initiate some conversation, but she's been forbidden to have any contact with him. Meanwhile, the Yojimbo is kind of infatuated with her, but she sees him as just kind of a scoundrel and a, you know, corrupted man. He doesn't pay his bills. He drinks too much. And that's the other thing with the Yojimbo character. He's just kind of like this greedy, lazy, hard-drinking, you know, just kind of a ne'er-do-well who he's still pretty good with the sword, but he's not really keeping himself sharpened to the full of his abilities. He's been somewhat corrupted. He knows he's, you know, working for a corrupt gang. And so his honor and his whatever samurai discipline that he had learned as a younger man has been pretty much compromised at this point. He's really just a hired sword, and he'll take anybody out if the price is right. Zatoichi is the man of principle in all of this, and even though it's not quite the, you know, every man, the hero sticking up for the lowly and poor and oppressed quite as plaintively as you see in some of the earlier films, where the poor villagers really are just the most servile, humble little peasants, kind of like in Seven Samurai, where you have just these quaking, quivering, fear-stricken salt of the earth types. Here he's in the midst of a bunch of, you know, dirty, rotten bastards, and he's trying to figure out which is the least dirty, rotten bastard of them all to align himself with. So that's basically the plot of it. I don't know, any other bits that people want to throw in there or anything else I can help clarify as to what's going on here?
I think you handled it quite well. I'm very proud of you.
Well, thank you. I feel a little bit of relief now.
If I were to do a really quick one, essentially the way I would say it is that there's a crooked plot to steal gold from the it seems like the national treasury, not just the local treasury, but there's this plot afoot to steal gold, and people suspect that the gold is being hidden in this town, and so all sorts of criminal elements come. Turf war. It has an element of like King Lear kind of turf war, though, because it's the father versus the son. But then you have all these crooked elements, and then you have Zatoichi, you know, who's some weird combination of some amazing combination of like Winnie the Pooh and you know, and a badass superhero. He kind of reminds me a little bit of the Incredible Hulk in that 70s or 80s show where he's just traveling from place to place trying to deal with his demons.
Yeah, and flashing his superpowers at just the right time in just the most uncanny way.
He basically saying, you don't want to see me mad, or that sort of thing. So all of that's going on. I think the film does a kind of a cool way of setting it up where Zatoichi wants to go home. He basically wants to go home to the Shire. You know, he wants to go home to this perfect place where, you know, he gets to feel the spring breeze and hear the stream and smell the plum blossoms. And then he gets there, and he thinks he's smelling the plum blossoms and hearing the stream and feeling the breeze. But, you know, you also see that there are dead bodies in that stream. You see that there's a massive graveyard. And he's like, oh, I'm at the border of the town. I'm so excited to be home. It's going to be all plum blossoms from here on out. And it's very clear that that is not the case. You know, one of the connections to Yojimbo or Sanjuro or, you know, go to the Sergio Leone movies. Like, he basically is this guy who wants to return to a Zen place. Whether or not he ever actually had that Zen place, I have no real sense. But he's imagining this nostalgic Zen place that he wants to return to escape from hell. And he just stumbles into another hell.
Yeah, and that's very much the themes of all the films. This one here is a little bit interesting because he goes back to his hometown, which is not necessarily where he was originally from, because I think there's another film coming up in the series which is his childhood home. But this is the home that he most recently had, at least within the series. His essential eternal wandering is a huge theme here, that there's no place he has to really rest his head. And of course, at the end of this film, he once again has to move on. He has to continue his sojourn, because even coming back home doesn't provide the rest and the solace that he was maybe hoping it would. So that kind of cycle continues, and we also see sort of a recitation of Zatoichi's kind of standard stunts. I mean, there's typically always at least one big gambling trick, and this one here by Zatoichi gambling terms is very straightforward. I mean, there are some that are much, much more elaborate, and I won't necessarily describe them here, except to say, if you guys like that little dice scene that he did here, this is kind of entry level stuff compared to some of the craziness of what happens in other ones. So those are always real highlights. And then, of course, slicing objects in midair, the time where he flips the coin and it lands right in the neck of the jar. I mean, those are just really whimsical, crazy moments. And it's the image, it's the illusion, that how they pull it off, and the way they kind of keep coming up with variations on I can't believe he just did that is just another kind of ongoing feature here of the Zatoichi series. So as far as those go, like, you know, when he slices the persimmon and it, you know, comes up into three chunks with a little bit of a delayed reaction there, when he slices the Ryu coin that Yojimbo tosses in the air and then takes a little bite, you know, this coin is, you know, the taste has changed. You know, it's just the great subtleties that he's able to detect with a flourish are just, those are just a little, the comforts that a seasoned Zatoichi aficionado will enjoy with each new discovery or before the return visit.
And those are the parts that I enjoyed most in the movie, the parts where it was a little eccentric and a little weird and a little like, oh, this isn't exactly what I expected it to be.
Yeah, so I think there's definitely hope that it gets better from here, Robert. So yeah, I wouldn't let this one set you back too much, or I certainly would not want this to serve as a discouragement from the series, but I do understand the confusion or the
anger.
Anger, yeah. Well, tell us, let's unpack that a little bit. I mean, so yeah, kind of what's your kind of summary or takeaway? Setting all my excuses or conciliatory comments aside, what was your kind of response to the film just after the first one?
No, it's simply, I'm just going to sort of reiterate what I had said before, but it was just, I had an expectation that it was going to be a delightful team up of, like, the sort of Charlie Chan-esque serial style samurai series where that just keeps going and going and going, meets the higher upper echelon Kurosawa fun of a wandering samurai bodyguard who sort of is playing everyone and you don't quite know what his real motivations are, and then neither really engaged me in any way. So I just kept coming back to, am I engaged by this? Do I care about the characters? And then I just kept saying, no, and I guess I sort of care about Zatoichi, but aside from that, not really. And that's why I think it just failed for me. It failed as film, it failed as part of the Kurosawa universe, and speaking about what you guys are saying, it sort of fails and sort of succeeds as a Zatoichi film. But, yeah, it just didn't engage me as a piece of art. It didn't engage me intellectually. I didn't want it to. I didn't necessarily need it to engage me intellectually. But since it didn't have much action until the very end either, I had nothing really to grab onto. That said, I'm really happy John liked it. And, David, you seem a little mixed on it. So, if it...
Yeah, there's a touch of bloat to this one that I think... is a bit regrettable. Now, would it have benefited from, you know, maybe 20 minutes of editing down to try to tighten up or make the story just a little bit more lean and efficient? I think you could make that argument, but given the film's apparent ambitions to try to sort of make this a cut above a legendary epic of the Zatoichi series, I think that's where the ambition set in, and so they had to expand and extend it, but they just may not have been able to, you know, hit the right notes. Their ambition might have exceeded their grasp is maybe one way of putting it.
I suppose my final, like, thoughts on the matter are, when you see a movie called Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo, you expect to have fun. I didn't have fun, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's fair, and that's a pretty accessible and legitimate perspective on it. So there may be viewers or listeners out there who are cheering you on, saying, "Yeah, you tell it like it is, Robert." But John, let's go ahead and give you a chance to kind of have a last take on it. Or do you want to talk about the inflationary monetary aspects of that?
Or do you just want to, you know, sharpen your knives and attack? It's fine. I understand.
No, so the with due humility around people that have seen a lot more of these movies. So clearly, I think this movie fails in two aspects, right? One, the plot is insanely convoluted. Perhaps the plot makes more sense for people that are Japanese and perhaps just have like have seen so many of these movies, and that's like the history that they grew up with, that it's really easy to tell. You know, there are two different places that get burnt down, and I'm like, who's getting their place burnt down, and whose guys are it's and it's very difficult to follow. So it definitely has that fault. And the other fault it has is that I think, with the exception of Zatoichi, all of the other characters, and as you pointed out, David, all the other characters are played by major actors. All of the other characters do feel like throwaway, and that's disappointing. So with that being said, I absolutely had a lot of fun with this movie, and this was my introduction to Zatoichi, so all of his themes and tropes and all the things going into the movie were all new to me. I think, you know, again, going back to Katsu's character here, this is one of the most interesting heroes that I've ever met. I expected this to be James Bond, right? Like, the first time I was introduced to anything about this movie series was having it described as essentially a Japanese version of James Bond. Same character, many different directors, and, you know, a long series of movies. But for James Bond is like this wish fulfillment guy. Like, he's not – it never feels to me like you're watching a real human being doing real things. Whereas when I see this – and obviously – the blind swordsman being the best swordsman in the land, it's far-fetched as well, but his attributes, he has like 50 different character attributes, and many of them are conflicting mm-hmm. with each other, and all of them he seems to use. He's not 100%, you know, he's a guy who genuinely stumbles on many occasions. He perhaps accidentally hits himself over the head with a rock, but when push comes to shove, when it's time for the gentle brush off, or the, you know, the knife to the belly, or the warm-hearted laugh, or, you know, whether it's time to carouse with a prostitute, or you know, to protect the virgin, like, this is a guy who just genuinely feels like he can wear all of the different faces that a human being, I think, has to wear to be like effective in the world. And it was just so much fun to see that. It did. It felt like I was seeing the Little Tramp in a samurai movie, and that was just right away very exciting for me. So the performance carried it for me. And yeah, and I thought that there were elements of the movie that was so beautifully shot, particularly the beginning. You know, because when I watch a film, I am absolutely one of those people that can get sucked in or turned off by the very opening shot or opening sequence. And this was one where I thought, wow, I am in for a treat. I am excited to watch this movie. As we've pointed out, perhaps yeah. There are points later on in the movie where, you know, it fails to live up to some of the hype of the beginning or to the movie title. But I thought overall, like, there were more moments of that than the rest of it. And I will say, one of the things I did like is that you have these – we follow the story of several characters that are on the periphery – end up playing significant roles, but really socially they're on the periphery of the storyline. And at the heart of the storyline is a storyline of corruption. And I thought it was really fun that it was a story about inflationary specie currency policy and you know, how that
love it.
How
yeah,
that plays
yeah.
out. The great moment was Zatoichi says, and this will cause a lot of pain for the very poor, and the corrupt official Yakuza boss is like, absolutely, it will. It's a very smart business.
He's just chuckling. Yeah, he's we've got these people right where we want them, you know? Yeah, well, I think that was a really wonderful summary of the character traits and the contradictions of the Zatoichi persona. And Shintaro Katsu really is exceptionally brilliant at juggling all those different aspects of a human being, a flawed person with some extraordinary abilities, but some literal and figurative blindness. I mean, he's not a Superman. He's not even necessarily an aspirational character like you wish you were him, you know, because he carries a lot of pain with him throughout all of these films. I mean, he can do incredible badass things, and he saves the day, and so you appreciate that, but you don't necessarily say, boy, I wish I was living that life, like you might with a James Bond type of character. But you're right, and there is a social economic conscience to these films as well, which does put it in a little bit of a you might even say a political context, where there's a humane ethic. I will advocate for a fair distribution of wealth and opportunities for people to live lives in peace and without the oppression of corrupt bosses exploiting them and grinding them into the dust. And so it is one of the things I really do appreciate about this series. And I think, again, this film has a lot going for it. I think it has some beautiful cinematography. I mean, this is a very dark film, the color palette, and I think by design that's part of the epic scale that they were striving for. Others are very brightly colored, you know, maybe not quite cartoonish, but certainly have a lot lighter tone. And so that's another thing I'll give you guys to look forward to in your discovery of the series is yeah, there's a lot of variety that's happening even within the rigors of the Zatoichi formula. So, okay, well, you know what? My computer is telling me I'm low on disk space. I might run out of recording any minute now. So,
time to go clean up some files. Oh my God, we broke David. God.
All right, guys. Well, I think we are going to wrap this one up. Any last comments? I think we've done our plugs and find us here's and there's. But any last wrap up? Robert, I'll kind of kick it your way for one more word.
I will spar with you guys anytime.
All right. Good to have you. John, wish you all the best, safe travels, and lots of fun. I think you got some interesting experiences ahead of you, my man. So thank you for getting into the mix here and talking some Zatoichi with me today.
Thanks for having me on, David. And Robert, it's so exciting to finally talk with you. This was great, and I look forward to chatting with you again. I don't know if soon is the right way to put it, because I'm going to be on vacation for a while, but definitely let's discuss some more movies, maybe argue over some movies at some point in the future.
Sounds like a plan, and until then, I'm going to go get a massage. If you want it, here it is, come and get it. Make your mind up fast. If you want it anytime, I can give it, but you better hurry, cause it may not last. You better hurry, cause it's going